Jared Diamond's Guns, Germs, and Steel, The Fates of Human Societies, winner of the Pulitzer Prize and the Phi Beta Kappa Award in Science, chronicles the way the modern world came to be and dismantles racially based theories of human history. To mark the book's 20th anniversary, the publisher has released a special edition that includes a new 2017 afterword from Diamond. Jared Diamond is professor of geography at UCLA and the author of the best-selling books Collapse and The Third Chimpanzee. He is a MacArthur Fellow and was awarded the National Medal of Science. Again, the 20th anniversary of Guns, Germs, and Steel, The Fates of Human Societies is the new book in paperback. And we welcome Professor Jared Diamond to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure to be back with you. Thank you.
Yes, you're one of our favorite guests here on the show, and I love this opportunity because it gave me the chance to read Guns, Germs, and Steel again. What has it been like for you to look at this work 20 years later?
Well, 20 years later, the conclusions basically remain the same, but the picture has been enriched. We've gotten more details, more information about the origins of advanced societies, of writing and metal tools and state governments over the last 10,000 years due to the origins of agriculture. And also economists have gotten interested a lot in the subject of my book. And in fact, the afterword that I provided to the new edition is about wealth and poverty in the modern world, one of the central issues that economists ask themselves.
You say that as the first line of your afterword to this anniversary edition. One of the central problems of economics concerns the wealth and poverty of nations. How so? And talk about the profound impact that indeed has.
Sure. Wealth and poverty of nations. Some countries like the United States and even more Norway and Liechtenstein are rich. Lots of countries, particularly countries in Africa and most countries in South America and many countries in Asia, are poor. And as for the importance of that, it's, of course, very sad for the inhabitants of all of those countries to die at early ages and not have our opportunities. But it's also very sad for us in this globalized world to be confronted with several billion people who now have ways of reaching us and venting their anger on us. And so the wealth and poverty of nations isn't just an abstract academic subject, but it's a matter of almost survival for the United States and for Europe. After all, there was yet another attack in London. One knows that these attacks occur in a climate of dissatisfied people in poor countries.
You talk about the academic nature of this, but put a human face on it for us of what this means today.
Sure. Here's a human example, and it's a plane flight that I took a dozen years ago from a European country, Netherlands, to an African country, Zambia. So within a short time, I'm between two countries. I start out in a country, the Netherlands, that seems to have everything against it. One third of the Netherlands is under sea level. The Netherlands shares a border with Germany, which has invaded and messed up the Netherlands. The Netherlands is so flat that its highest hill is 800 feet, meaning no rivers, no hydroelectric power. The Netherlands doesn't have much in the way of natural resources, and it's cold, so they get off one crop a year, everything going against it. And then I fly to Zambia, this tropical country, which is warm, so they have several crops a year. Zambia is the world's, I think, second largest producer of copper. And on the Zambezi River, it has dams that produce so much hydroelectric power that Zambia doesn't have to import oil for its electricity needs, but in fact, it exports electricity. So here, within a day, between two countries, one is rich and one is poor. And no, it's not the case that Zambia is rich and Netherlands is poor. It's instead the case that the Netherlands is rich, 35 times richer, higher incomes than Zambia, despite all those disadvantages. And of course, the poverty of Zambia means that Zambians die at an average age of something like 42. They don't have great educational opportunities. So there's a human face on wealth and poverty.
You make this point in the book about how, in the afterword, about how economists often attribute national wealth to what is called human institutions. And I would like you to talk a little bit about human institutions, but also how you say there is increasing recognition among economists themselves that this idea of good institutions is incomplete. Not wrong, but not the full story.
Sure. Let's do that in two pieces. One, the good institutions. So what are good institutions that make countries rich and countries without them poor? They're pretty obvious. Good institutions mean that political leaders don't get assassinated. That happens often in some countries. Good institution means low level of corruption. It means that contracts get enforced. It means that laws get obeyed. It means that there are incentives for investing, because if you invest, your money isn't going to get taken away from you. There are some countries, like the United States and most European countries and Japan and Australia, that have those good institutions which help them get rich. And there are lots of countries where those good institutions don't prevail, but where people get assassinated and there's corruption, and there's no doubt that that contributes to poverty. The problem is that economists are right in pointing out that factor, but they're incomplete in saying that that is the total explanation for wealth and poverty.
So when you look at that, will we always see the United States, for example, as getting richer, and will we always see, say, the Philippines always remaining poor and getting poorer?
The answer to your questions is no and no. Will the United States continue to get richer? Well, we Americans are very concerned about what's going on in the United States now. There's a lot going on that's unfavorable, and there's justified concern that the United States may be losing its competitive position in the world. As for poor countries, conversely, poor countries getting richer, within my lifetime, and I'm sure within the lifetime of most of our listeners, there are countries that started out poor that have ended up rich. For example, Botswana, the African country Botswana, when it became independent in 1966, it was, I think, the poorest country in Africa. And today, Botswana today is the second richest country in Africa. Or again, South Korea, when I was a child, South Korea was really poor, and today South Korea is a highly developed first world country. So poor countries can get rich, and rich countries like Argentina in the past, and we'll see about the United States today, can squander their advantages.
Jared Diamond is our guest. The book is Guns, Germs, and Steel, The Fates of Human Societies. The book won the Pulitzer Prize, and the 20th anniversary edition with a new afterword has just been published. In the epilogue of the book, you talk about the future of human history as a science. Explain that idea of human history as a science, coming from you, a geography professor.
Sure, human history. So is it a science? Well, you look at where it's taught in universities. At some universities, it's in the humanities part of a college, not a science. At other universities, it's in the social science part of the college, but somewhat uneasily. At one university that I visited, the graduate school of history was in the humanities department, and the undergraduate school was in the social sciences, all of which means that the discipline of history sits uneasily on the edge between humanities and a science. Sciences have to do with establishing facts, reaching conclusions, saying that there are things that you know, that the things that you don't know change every generation depending upon one's changes in views. But history, by that standard, is marginally a science. There are historians who pursue history somewhat scientifically, and there are lots of historians who say that each generation has to reinvent, retell the past according to its own standards, which is certainly not a science. We don't say that Newton's laws have to be reinterpreted by kids born in the year 2000 because things change. So history is on the edge. My view, because I come from a background of laboratory physiology and I've been involved in genetics and ecology and evolution, my view is that history can be pursued scientifically like other social sciences that include economics and sociology and linguistics.
You say this, let's go back to the beginning of the book and the introduction, where you talk about the question motivating the book is, why did history unfold differently on different continents? And you write, in case this question immediately makes you shudder at the thought that you are about to read a racist treatise, you aren't. As you will see, the answers to the questions don't involve human racial differences at all. The book's emphasis is on the search for ultimate explanations, and I'm pushing back the chain of historical causation as far as possible. A two-part question. One, were you always aware of that in reading it, that the racial component was something that you were going to, that would not be a part of this particular story?
Answer to that, no, I was not aware of that. I grew up in the United States, and so I acquired the usual American views, and therefore it's a big surprise for me when I went out to the island of New Guinea, that tropical island just north of Australia, where I knew that people had, until recently, been using stone tools, never had had state government, never had writing, never had metal tools. I went out there naive, thinking that New Guineans had so-called primitive technology because of something about them. And it took me about one day to realize that New Guineans are at least as smart as Americans and are realistically, on the average, a little smarter. So there must be some other explanation. That was in 1964. It took me decades to work out what the explanation was. And so Guns, Germs, and Steel was not published until 1997. The explanations for why history unfolded on different continents have to do not with differences among people, but instead with differences between the continents themselves.
When you took on this and you look at this ultimate question, I think one of the fascinating details is that when you look at the United States, of caring about others, that caring about outside the bubble. And I guess I asked the question of how you look at it now, and something that I guess really hasn't changed in 20 years since you wrote this book.
So you're thinking about Americans being concerned outside the bubble, that's to say being concerned about the rest of the world?
Yes.
Sure. So what is it in the last several decades that has made Americans concerned about the rest of the world? Well, most recently, of course, September 11, 2001, which shows us that people far away in poor countries that we ignored in the past can have big consequences for the United States. But this is also illustrated by what in retrospect is a cruel joke that diplomats, American diplomats and secretaries of state used to tell each other. American diplomats used to say in the 1950s and 1960s, here are three countries, and they're really, or they used to say, what are the countries in the world most irrelevant to U.S. interests because they're never going to affect the United States, they're so poor and they're so far away. And the usual candidates in the 1960s for countries that the United States would never have to care about were Afghanistan, because it's landlocked and poor, and Somalia, because it's also poor, and Iraq, because it had nothing going for itself then except oil. And those are, of course, the three countries where American troops have gone in recently, making the point that nowadays, in this globalized world, every country in the world affects the United States.
In writing about 13,000 years of history, I feel somewhat embarrassed asking you about concerns over the next 4 years. So, but it is an apt question, isn't it? I mean, it is appropriate.
That is putting it mildly. Yes, it's appropriate. I'm the father of twin sons who will reach their 30th birthday next month, and I'll shortly celebrate my 80th birthday, which means that my sons will celebrate their 80th birthday in the year 2067, which means that I care a lot about what the world is going to be like, not just in the year 2021, but in the year 2067. That's a subject that really grabs us.
But you look at 13,000 years of history, and you do wonder, okay, you're looking at these entire huge swaths of times and development. But it seems that, and maybe we always feel that we're at some sort of turning point, but especially now we seem we're at a turning point, and quite frankly, a very dangerous one.
I agree with you. You're right that on the one hand, every decade of my life, Americans have felt this is the hardest time we've ever faced in the United States. And when one says that again and again, you have to be suspicious that this really is the hardest time. But nevertheless, I would say now really is the most challenging decade of my life in the United States. The problems that we face are the most serious problems. And partly it's a matter of running out of time. Namely, we're using up world resources at the rate that we're going now. In a few decades, we'll be coming to a real crunch with resources like fisheries and water and topsoil and forests. So on the one hand, the clock is ticking. And on the other hand, there are big dangerous problems now. There's the nuclear problem, as always, but now nuclear weapons are in the hands of North Korea. There's the problem of exploding immigration, that billions of people around the world have good reason not to be satisfied with where they're living, and they now have the means, the boat and the plane and other means to move to other countries. So we face severe problems that are going to get resolved either in a nice way or in a bad way in the next few decades.
And in substantial ways that really look to this whole question about who has what, correct?
Sure. In substantial ways about who has what, both who has what good things and who has what bad things.
Right.
To take an example of who has what bad things, malaria is the most serious infectious disease in the world. There are far more cases of malaria than there are of AIDS. And malaria is particularly a tropical disease that drags down the health, but also the economies of people in tropical countries, because if you train someone as an engineer or whatever, and then they die at age 45, that means that there's a short payoff time for them. But malaria is a disease that would be relatively easy to cure with more money. The estimates are that something like $20 or $30 billion would suffice to put most people around the world in malaria zones inside insecticide impregnated mosquito nets at night, and that's enough to interrupt the transmission of malaria. So there's an example of how foreign aid, well-directed foreign aid, for not a very large amount of money, could go a long way towards solving one of the world's major problems.
How do you look at our place in the world and a what seems to be an overall shift away from a lot of the good work that was being done in the last decade or so to combat many of these problems, certainly health related, but most substantially climate related? We were in big trouble, and we were trying to catch up, and now it seems we're moving in the opposite direction. So I'm interested not just from a United States perspective, but really from a world perspective.
Sure. As for where the first part of your question about where the United States stands in the world, it's clear the United States is the world's richest large country. The only countries with higher incomes are these small countries of Liechtenstein and Norway. We have the world's largest or second largest economy. China now has an economy about the same size as ours, mainly because there are five times more Chinese than there are Americans, but average income per person in the United States is much higher than in China. And we have the world's only worldwide military. There's no other country that has 10 nuclear-powered aircraft carriers that sail all around the world. So the United States today still is the most powerful and richest country for good reasons of geography and history and society. As for the problems that we face, you mentioned the problem of climate change. That's a problem for people all around the world, including us Americans. Here I'm sitting in Los Angeles, and Los Angeles this year is having its wettest year in recorded history, and last year Los Angeles had its driest year in recorded history, which makes the point that climate change is not just a matter of global warming, of temperatures getting warmer, but also of increased variability, of there being not only warmer years, but also colder years, and there being more storms, more hurricanes. So climate change is a big worldwide problem. Inequality is a big worldwide problem. Running out of resources, and then the nuclear risk, those I see as the world's four big problems.
Jared Diamond is professor of geography at UCLA and the author of The Third Chimpanzee Collapse and many other works. Guns, Germs, and Steel, The Fates of Human Societies has just been published in a 20th anniversary paperback edition with a new afterword. Jared Diamond, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Always very nice to speak to you and hear your great brilliance. I thank you very much.
Thank you, and it's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book is Guns, Germs, and Steel, The Fates of Human Societies. It's published by Norton. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.